Our people are generous. This is our day. Your ancestors have all arrived. The past has arrived. Behold. Listen. All is established here. We are relatives. This planet Earth and all upon it turns into view. The Earth is in our hands. Let it fly. Let it fly. As it moves, we will rejoice. Approach in a beautiful manner. Approach in your best buckskin. Thanks, all the people are crying. And thanks, Grandmother of the center of the Earth. Thanks. 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 Well, this is... this is not craft, this is witchcraft. I would just like to say something about my life's work in relation to craft and in relation to the contents and the form of writing, of communication, I would like to say. I have a very deep feeling, which I think is very native to America and somewhat lost in our in the 20th century existentialism and elitism that I mentioned the other night, and I think is now returning in what I call the new people. There's people coming on this earth that never have been here before. I have to read up to talk to my great-grandchildren. I mean, they never had all of the terrible teaching. Everything that I learned when I was in school is not true to them. I early had this in Kansas when I was about 10 years old. I was studying in school. We never studied anything American. You had to be a British writer. Dickens, to me, in Kansas meant absolutely nothing. I mean, I never saw a city. In all the literature of Europe, in fact, my grandmother thought European literature and music was actually a sin. I mean, there was a tremendous feeling, a rejection in American people of European intellectualism and European culture, which was not a bad response, actually, because we had a hard time. You don't realize what a hard time American culture had breaking away from European culture. I was at the first artist meeting in New York when they revolted against the French in 1914, when the artists revolted against the French dominating American art and had the Armory Show. Maybe some of you have read about that in history. This was a tremendous thing to have American art. And in 1921, when I saw on Stieglitz's door where it said the American place, I almost fainted. You don't realize what that meant. I knew there was an American place, but I never saw it. When Stieglitz started to photograph American horses, even, and American, you can't realize what a struggle that was, American culture, to break away from European art. And Sherwood Anderson, all those heroic people that tried the theater, there was the Provincetown Theater of Eugene O'Neill, and this was a tremendous thing to break away from European theater. It was tremendous to have a little place on the wharf where we had American plays. And when I first saw O'Neill, it was the same thing. An American play about American Puritans, about my grandmothers and all that terrible thing in O'Neill that he began to write about. Now we accept that, but then it was a tremendous thing to even write about an American person. Sherwood Anderson, even Rolvag was published first in his own language in Sweden or Norway, and he wrote the great saga about the plains. You couldn't get anything published. I just want to indicate what a tremendous thing it was to attach ourselves to the American people, to the American democratic heritage. To the Whitman was not read then because he was considered by the intellectuals to be a yokel. In fact, we just recently had a professor at Minnesota who taught Whitman as a fascist, said Whitman was a fascist because he was for the people. And there's a whole school that says that is a fascistic, that Hitler blood and all of his, it was the folk thing they misinterpret. I just want to indicate the first writing that I did, I sat behind
in Fort Scott, Kansas. We had a water trough, you know, the farmers on Saturday watered their horses. It took me, it was 30 years before I found out that was John Brown's Square where John Brown met before he went in the race in Missouri. No one ever told me that. I must have seen him walking by occasionally. But I sat under the water trough taking down what the farmer said. I thought this must be my literature, not Dickens. But I made a mistake of taking it down and sending it to my English teacher I think it was a freshman in high school. And she called my mother. We didn't have phones. She encountered my mother and said, "What is your daughter doing? You know, what terrible places is she hanging out?" Because I always put in all the four-letter words, and I put in everything I heard. And I thought it was poetic speech. I thought that was the first poetic speech that I heard. And I've been listening ever since to that. And I do think that the people, the experiences, the people, America has one of the greatest poetic speeches in the world, if you just listen in the taverns and the bus and the factories and the workplaces and so on, and take it down. Gage said that it took 800 years of folk speech to create him. And I think we should begin to have that feeling that our language and our experience has come from 200 years of the American experience. And we have now literature that's going back to that. Carl Sandburg, I heard Carl Sandburg hissed in the University of Minnesota in 1931 when he was reading his poetry. You couldn't speak at the University of Minnesota unless you were a British author, a nice woman author, if you could get one. I mean, the whole English department was geared to European culture in 1931. And here we had in Minnesota a tremendous heritage of people's struggles, of third party struggles, of Communist Party, of the co-ops, of the IWW. We had this tremendous, dramatic heritage, and it was left practically for several generations in the academic world untouched. And people like Carl Sandburg and Edgar Lee Masters and Rachel Lindsay. Have you ever read Rachel Lindsay?
If you go back to that kind of music, and these people also were troubadours. They went out. Rachel Lindsay went across the whole America selling his poems for a penny. And he always was a singer, a great, marvelous singer. I mean, when you saw him, he was an angel reciting his poetry, singing his poetry. And he always had that sense of coming from Illinois, from the roots. And you can see his house now if you go to Springfield, Illinois. And, of course, he killed himself by drinking the great American drink, Lysol, when he was not 38, I think. So I just want to bring the great contents of our history and of our... I have here encountered several people that are doing that, like Sharon's wonderful saga of coming across America, which is marvelous evocation, not only of the objective physical America, but the dream, the psychic essence of America, which is very great, really. I mean, it's underneath the... Some people say, like the I'm sure you studied in school that the Dakota Sioux Indian was extinct, that his culture was extinct, his language was extinct. That was only about 10 years ago. And that the Dakotas had given, when it was in 1890, the government forbade them to speak their own language and forbade them to do the sun dance. Not forbade them, it was illegal. Now, in 73, after Wounded Knee, it turns out that they gave 500 songs that are part of the Sundance. Every family had a song to learn and pass down and secrete from the government. So now they can put all these songs together and they're reproducing the Sundance. Same with the language. There was one person in every family who carried on the language secretly. You could be arrested for speaking Lakota in all those years. So I have a feeling that the people and struggle and the people's experience only goes underground. We are always saying, well, the people are dead, the people are silent. Remember before the hippie movement, everybody said the American student was silent. And then all of a sudden, they burst. Be careful when the American people seem to be silent. And this is a very important thing to... I went with Neruda across South Dakota when he was in exile. And Neruda is not an easy poet. He's a very surrealist poet, really. He read his poetry in old schoolhouses with kerosene lamps, and everybody understood everything he was saying because of his content. Because he was talking about the land, he was talking about oppression, and no matter what language or what images, it might be very subtle or surrealistic. Everybody understood. There was an old man in one of the schoolhouses who started forward, and we were standing there with a book, and he had a quite beard, I remember, and he just came forward. He said, "Give me that book." He said, "Is that in that book?" It was about let the rail splitter awake, it was. And it was about the farmer and letting Lincoln come back in America again and so on. And he understood every word of that, because I think if it's about what people know, the language, you can raise the level of language and concept. In the Spanish War, a strange thing happened, that Lorca and Defia and that other poet, his name, that they were really far out, avant-garde, as far as form goes. During the Spanish War, they went out to the villages. These men, these sophisticated, cosmopolitan, you might say, already with a world reputation, and they did plays and murals in front of the villages who never had any contact with the cosmopolitan world. And they all said it was a great experience to them because they had an audience that responded, and they were fed as well as given, and there was nobody who didn't understand them, probably more than the cosmopolitan world. So I read my poetry, and Carl Sandburg, you should read his poetry everywhere, outdoors, on the street, in taverns. He was unknown until he wrote the Lincoln books. He was unknown except to the American people. And he didn't make any money, and until he wrote the Lincoln books, he was 60 over then. He really just wrote his poetry and recited it, and it was sung in the cars, and the people knew it. So it's something to think about, I think. Who is our audience? Who are we writing for? And what consciousness are we raising as poets? Is our function to raise the consciousness of the people, or what is our function? Just to murmur to each other, or to be heard, or to... I think we should go back to handing... The IWWs used to hand out poems on the street. We did that in St. Paul last year, and it was gobbled up. But of course, a lot of people don't... Alan Tate, when he came to Minnesota, he said, "I don't like to come to Minnesota because too many people know how to read." He said, in Tennessee, only 2% of the people know how to read, so I don't have to worry about an audience. He said that in a public meeting. It was a library meeting. I was very proud of our librarians, because they do believe in reading. And at the when we were supposed to go and shake his hand, not one librarian shook his hand. But think of the arrogance of a poet who actually doesn't want an audience. It's a certain kind of elitist audience. So I, in my life, I've really tried to not only write the poems, but I think it's been given to me. To me, the form and structure of Carl Sandburg, The People Yes, for example, came from the street, came from the people, he has whole parts of quotations from the people. I wrote a book called North Star Country, which is made up entirely of people's sayings, of the reaction of the people, that I found had form and content and beauty and elegance and human content more than I myself alone could conceive of or made. So I went everywhere in the libraries, and we have in Minnesota a wonderful thing of people printing their own books. The village newspaper was once a week, and when the printing press was empty, you could pay a little bit and have your little book published and traded for eggs or ham or something. But this is a great tradition in Minnesota. You can go to the historical library and see these great... I mean, they're not great poems, but they're great sources of poetry, like Gaeta said. So I feel it's part of the poem to take from the people and give it back to the people, to raise the consciousness of a democratic people. And as Lorca says, you take the image from the people and you refine it through yourself, and you give it back. And you have, you function then as a conduit, as a transistor, and you have stepped up the vibration and the sound and so on, and you hand it back. This is, to me, the only way that the artist can live is that circulation, and that it's a resonance. If nothing is resonating to your poetry or to you or to your life, there's silence. I think we have to go back to that whole theory, that not a theory, but what science says about nature. Everything resonates. There's nothing that does not resound. In the Indian, some of the Indian celebrations, if they don't include a cricket in their yearly prayer, the crickets are going to be revolting. At the great treaty meeting in 2 years ago, when all the Indians of the Americas met in Switzerland, one of the Indians got up and said, "There's somebody missing here." He said, "We haven't invited the bears, the coyotes, or the buffaloes." And he said, "They were oppressed. They were, you know, wiped out, genocide." He made a whole speech. It was a genocide practice on his brothers. The buffalo was taken very seriously by the
next meeting, they'll invite them. So I think that this feeling of resonance is very important to
not only a writer, but to us all. We are losing that relationship of people can stand to hear almost anything. Sometimes this sympathy is almost disappearing in people. I think it's a very serious thing that feeling, if you don't relate to everything, you have no feeling of that nature. So I think that the experiments here, I don't know if you know Pauline Oliveras, a great woman composer who's in the University of San Diego, believes that all sound is communal. That if 100 people are making a sound, they will eventually come up with a communal sound. And I think this is true. And she has experiments with hundreds of people outdoors. Marvelous. She calls it sonic meditation. And but it all is based upon that everything is reflected and resounding and resonating with everything else. You can't do anything or have a thought that is not part of the universe. So obviously you can't pollute the rivers or pollute everything. So I think that's my entire witchcraft is witchcraft. And I know isn't popular in some places to have that thing that there is an audience, that there is a content and a form in the experiences of our people. But I think it's true. And the longer I live, the more I see that they are the magnetic field in which everything happens. And I think in the future we see that even more in the struggle against pollution and nuclear. And it's nobody that is responding except the people are saying no to that. So with that, we're going on with our communal experience. You want to say something about the... I'm not going to read that as a poem. You want to say something about the solidarity.
Okay. Maridol has been talking a lot about the community and how we resonate and rebound off of each other, resound off of each other. We're going to come back to the sound again, as we did in the beginning. Only this time, along with the humming, we want a word. And a word that means something to you of community. And of the community in this room, maybe, or the community that we've shared the last 2 weeks, of the community you'll be going back to when you leave here, and keep it, you know, we can just go all over the place with it. Think of the words that mean that to you, and say it. Say, like, if it's solidarity, just, you know, solidarity, and go all over the place with it, and come back to it. And if it's communal, or if it's whole, or just play with it like you did with the sound and let it go and listen to each other, and we'll come out with different words. Maybe we'll pick up the same words and do that. It's not easy, but we're going to try to do that.
You don't have to try hard. The word will come to you. Just you have to choose to say it. It's hard to keep going. You might not find it hard to keep going, but a lot of people have expressed that. It's not all was easy.
And if you hear a word of your neighbor, pick up that word, like we were picking up the sound in the beginning, or the tone in the beginning. If somebody's saying a word that means it to you, you pick it up and go with it too.
Sure, nobody owns a word, steal.
predators plan to live within your bodies. They plan to wring out of unpaid labor, wrench their wealth from our bodies. They intend to bore inside the women host, open the artery, consume, devour, drill for oil, eat the flesh of the earth mother. Like the earth, they will consume all woman flesh and the commodities of her being. The harbors of the world will be for the sale of her body.
The sweatshops will multiply stolen wealth of her living skin. They slaver at the cheap labor of women around the world. They will ground us in the metallic like living corn.
We are wine, strapped to the ground, spilled. We are a great granary of seeds smashed and burned. We are a garrisoned flight of doves. We are face out of bones, years of labor bend the bone and back. We receive a thousand blows, thefts of ovum and child, meadows of dead and bruised wings. Body trash dies. There is no abstract death or death at a distance. Our bodies extend into the body of all. Every moment is significant in solidarity. In solidarity, I stood at the gates of Honeywell, where the mother bomb was timed and triggered. I hid my grandsons from the gun. I crouched under the terrible flames of Johnson, Nixon, and Kissinger. I felt the boots on your throat as my own. I saw the guns pointed at us all. Women of the earth bear the weight of the oppressor, bearing us down into deep to glow upward from the dark, from the womb, from the abyss of blood, from the injured screams. From glow we glow and rise singing. I saw the women of the earth rising on the horizons of nitrogen. I saw the women of the earth coming toward each other. What do we say? I saw the women of the earth rising on horizons of nitrogen. I saw the women of the earth coming towards each other with praise and heat, without reservations of space, all shining in a light in solidarity, transforming the womb into bread and children in a new abundance, a global summer. Tall and crying out in song, we arise in mass meadows. We will line the living hills with our seed. We will redeem all hostages. We will light the bowl of life. We will light singing across all seas. The resonance of the song of women, lifted green, alive, in the solidarity of communal love, uncovering the illumined fruit, the flowering pollen, in the thighs of golden bees. We bring to you our fire, we pledge to you our guerrilla fight against the predators of our country. We come with thunder, lightning on our skins, roaring wombs singing, our sisters singing, choruses of millions are singing. So I am making a sacred smoke for all the people may behold. We are passing with great power over the prairie. The light is upon our people, making the earth bright. Feathers of sage and cedar upon our breasts, shaking on wrists, ankles, tail of the red fox, lighting us. We are crying for a vision. Behold us that our people may live. Our people are generous. This is our day. Your ancestors have all arrived. The past has arrived. Behold. Listen. All is established here. We are relatives. This planet Earth and all upon it turns into view.
Earth is in our hands. Let it fly. Bird of earth and light, and all that moves will rejoice. Approach in a beautiful manner. Approach together.
Approach in solidarity. Thanks, all the people are crying. And thanks, grandmother of the center of the earth. Thanks. Now. Well. Do you want to do the... Thank you.
And fear, fear everywhere on the streets in the gray winter of the land, and the curious death in the air, and the bright surface activity of the pioneer town in the curious air, dissipating powers of fear and hate. The Middle West is all so familiar to me, and yet it is always unfamiliar, a dream, an unreality. There are Kansas, Iowa, Illinois, Nebraska. They were for a long time frontier states. Their villages are yet the waste and ashes of pioneering, and the people too waste and ash, with the inner fire left out. There is still the pioneer tension, as if something was still to be done, something conquered, something overcome, and there is no longer anything to conquer and no longer an enemy. I have walked around the streets of many small towns in Kansas. I have traveled over the country looking and looking. I lived my impressionable years in a Kansas corn village. In my youth as now, I was looking for sustenance. I was looking for something to live on. I was trying to grow, to come alive. In the mid-center of America, a man can go blank for a long, long time. There is no community to give him life, so he can go lost as if he were in a jungle. No one will pay any attention. He can simply be as lost as if he had gone into the heart of an empty continent. A sensitive child can be lost, too, amidst all the emptiness and ghostliness. I am filled with terror when I think of the emptiness and ghostliness of mid-America. The rigors of conquest have made us spiritually insulated against human values. No fund of instinct and experience has been accumulated, and each generation seems to be more impoverished than the last. I am filled with terror when I think of the emptiness and ghostliness of mid-America. The rigors of conquest have made us spiritually insulated against human values. No fund of instinct and experience has been accumulated, and each generation seems to be more impoverished than the last. Look at the face of the Middle Westerner, and you know he has been nourished in a poor soil without one day of good growing weather. Yet there is the land abundant in seasons. I have looked and looked at the land. The symbols of this country are winter, the departure of the year, the, quote, death of all sweet things, unquote. It is the symbol of man's foreboding and his birth and his death. Life is not embodied. It is either just dying or being born. Who can tell? All our Americans have had this anxiety of life at the low ebb. I had it in my youth and still have it, a sickening anxiety like a disease, and all in the small town where I lived, had it. It was limed in their faces like the ravages of some plague, some mysterious unmentioned disease of which we're all suffering. The sun leaving the earth and the terrible insecurity at the bottom of every man's soul, fears, dangers, hardships known and unknown, as if one were never going to live to maturity. The days so tenuous in substance, a sheer fabric of horror, and the town falling to pieces with its rotten wooden houses and the gray shredded fences and the place of horror, out of the world, doomed. I could not bear to get up in the morning after the winter solstice, as if some malignant power were in the air, the dim, dim faces, the blank interior of the continent, the winter madness coming on, the winter death, the sun leaving the great dark continent, the black, cold prairies, the shocks of corn desolate in the fields, the earth obtained in the cold sunlight, the smell of loam, the dark fields jagged and turned to the cold, the cattle wading through the black frozen mud, and the wild embodied wind of the prairies like a presence among the fields. The terrifying beauty, too, of the plains, the black stiff trees shadowless, the soft shadowless ice world curving beneath the shadowless sky, boys tracking down the valley, gophers hanging from their belts, gopher tails from their stocking caps, men swathed in woolens watching the eastbound train, a hunter coming into the village, a rabbit hanging from his arm, the blood dropping from its eyes. The farmhouses silent in the gullies in the low curve of plain, the horses in the frozen corn, the smoke of the little brush trees in the midst of frost, the white earth sloping and still, the leaden sky, all things closed, no vista, no shaking out, no revelation. Where has life gone that there is no fire and no shadow? I was born on these prairies while the land was lying low in the midwinter solstice, lying low like this and dreaming. It curves now in low, long swells, lying stark in the blue frost, so strong, so spare. Men come out of the wooden houses. I see their naked red arms, their hulking shoulders, their stubborn stocky heads. They run from the house to the barn, ducking their heads against the wind. These meaty men live in this delicate world, their bloody lives, and they looked upon and are looked upon by the rabbit, the prairie dog, and once the deer. Why does an American think about the land? What dreams come from the sight of it? What painful dreaming? Are they only money dreams, power dreams? Is that why the land lies desolate like a loved woman who has been forgotten? Has she been misused through the dreams of power and conquest? Anyhow, the awful imprecations of the land lie heavily on the guilty white spirit. Remember the sadness and the innate depression of Lincoln as symbolic. He was naturally a lover, but he never loved the land, though he walked miles over it, slept and lived on it, and buried the bodies of those he loved in it. And yet he was never struck with that poetry and passion that makes a man secure upon this land, his land. There was always instead this convulsion of anxiety, this fear. I'm going to end the reading here from the book, but let me talk about the Simmonses, who were evidently neighbors of theirs. Their car had stalled in front of the Simmonses' house, and eventually they were invited in. But she speaks of Mr. Simmons' house as such. Their house was a wooden one, shambling, behind a windbreak of trees, and the barns were better than the house, and the stock better than the people. Here's another one on page 20. There was an Irish family I knew who lived out a few miles from town. They were lazy and enjoyed themselves, and were considered somehow immoral by the townspeople. All the foreigners in the town were isolated by their gaiety, the festivals, easy love and birth. They were always attractive to me, the foreign girl prostitutes, the great Polish woman who kept a house where the college boys went and whose name we were forbidden to speak. I liked her body, so rich and loose, and her broad-hipped, lazy walk. The acrid Yankee body is a hard thing to live with. Always ungiven, held taut for some unknown fray with the devil, or the world, or the flesh. These illicit women, so menacing, were the only ones at that time who could wear bright colors. This Irish family, Irish and Goaty, came to town on Saturday, and I liked to ride out with them. They had large, earthy, loose faces. We rode in a wagon through the hard, tight Kansas cold, the ruts frozen so hard our teeth rattled. No snow, just the frozen bald earth and the black scrub trees. The house was a little white house sitting on the top slope of the prairie. It was dirty and derelict. The inside would be cold, and we would be cold, our hands and legs chapped and raw. Out of every window we could see the desolate cold prairie and the wind over it, the frozen stiff corn in the fields. And at last there would be a fire in the stove, the lamps would be lighted. There was no evidence of anyone living in the house. There were chairs, beds, adequate things, but it was like a camp, no idols, no tokens of intimate life. And then Mrs. Kelly would fry the thick fat pork and cook the potatoes in their jackets, and then we would eat in the lamplight, grinning at each other in that wild, wild way they had, and making jokes, prodding each other slyly, and eating the rich pork and gravy, too rich and porky. No wine, no grace, just the greasy, porky meal with the raucous plain lopping outside to the dismal horizon, and the sly human grinning at each other, the sly grin of the Irish goaty faces, bewildered too, but chewing a good cut of life, somehow, that they had brought with them over a black sea. Something about their religious background, point here. Another violence, the revival. The evangelist would be a strange man, often handsome. The young girls would stand in bright group, twittering as he came to town, into town, shying off yet eyeing him and he them. The boys would watch him going down Main Street. The matrons asked him to their tables. There were dreams of him in the night. Even my grandmother got excited. The opening night of the revival, there was always something special on our table. The dinner was a little better. There was a hint of rite and symbol. I never saw her so excited as upon these nights of revival, so happy, so contented. She was like an actress on her opening night. She put on her best dress. She was affectionate even. And my grandmother never kissed us. She was embarrassed by an excess of feeling and had a way of turning down her lips bitterly. She had that acrid, bitter thing, too, about her body, a kind of sourness, as if she had abandoned it. It was like an abandoned thing. Perhaps it had not been occupied. The Puritans used the body like the land, as a commodity, and the land and the body resent it. She never took a bath except under her shift. hearing her move about her room alone. I always wondered what she was doing, so bodiless, with that acrid odor, as if she had buried her body, murdered and buried it, and it gave off the secret odors revealing the place where it lay. Yet she was faithful in her duties, dogged in her service to those she loved, but it seemed to be a sacrifice without love, without joy, a love without passion, and her children, like the children of everyone, seemed to have been born without contact. Pleasure of any kind was wicked, and she never lay down in the daytime even when she was dreadfully tired. It would have been a kind of licentiousness to her to have done so. The coldness in her and the severity gave her that sense of always spying on others, and she did have that passionate curiosity that comes in people marooned in any way from life by spiritual or physical illness. But religion was her theater, her dance, her wine, her song. Every night, sitting bolt upright in her strong, stiff body, she sang these haunting hymns, picking them out in dull chords on the untuned piano. It was a long time before I knew that they were her love songs, the only ones she and others had. With a brilliant husband and four children, she was mysteriously marooned, unliving and ghost-like, without abundance or contact, without bloom in her body, without essential growth or maturity. Following a description of a typical revival evening, she now goes on and talks about the opening up of the people after the revival meeting, and then all of a sudden they're locking down again, and that's the close of the freeing of these people. And she says, but the revival ends too, and the stranger leaves town. The sinners forget they have been saved. The great mid-continent vacuum swallows everything again. Everything is quiet until the corn husking, and that means work and competitions. Oh, Kansas, I know all your little trees. I have watched them thaw and bud in the pools of winter frozen over, the silos in the corn blue sky, the wagon track road with the print of hooves going where, and little creeks gullying with delicate grasses and animals, the prairie dog, the rabbit, and your country with a sense of ruin and desolation like a strong, raped virgin, and the mind scurrying like a rabbit, trying to get into your meaning, making things up about you, trying to get you alive with significance and myth. I have seen this spring like an idiotic, lost peasant come over your prairies, scattering those incredibly tiny flowers, the frozen earth thaw to black mud, and a mist of greening come on the thickets, and the birds coming from the south, black in the sky, and farmers coming to the village through the black mud. I have seen your beauty and your terror and your evil. I have come from you mysteriously wounded. I have waked from my adolescence to find a wound inflicted on the deep heart, and have seen it in others too, disabled men, and sour women made ugly by ambition, mortified in the flesh and wounded in love. Not going to Paris or Morocco or Venice, instead staying with you, trying to be in love with you, bent upon understanding you, bringing you to life, and for your life is my life, and your death is mine also.
Yeah, there's a article called Annunciation, which is a letter for her oldest daughter, Rachel, and talks about her pregnancy and Rachel's birth in San Francisco. Meridol also speaks of this time as getting into the habit of writing notes on little bits of paper, and she says this is where she thinks she began her writing of things down. And here she said about having problems with her husband, lover, at that time. I stopped talking to him much. Everything I said only made him angry. So writing was a kind of conversation I carried on with myself and with the child. Yeah, she speaks of traveling with this child in her stomach, in her womb, all over from Tijuana to San Francisco, in trains, over mountains, through deserts and hotels and rooming houses, and myself in a trance of wonder. There wasn't a person I could have told it to, that I was going to have a child. That's where I was confused, because I was looking at the
looking at this, and then I knew you had said Murray, and I thought it was Iowa, and then I said, I knew you had said Murray, and I thought it was Iowa.
Yeah.
But then I,
It's still there. It's a little town. I'm torn out. It's kind of a bedroom for Osceola, a larger town.
Yeah, this, what would be the largest town closest to this?
Largest what?
The largest city or town closest to Murray.
Osceola.
And you mentioned in one of the stories, you mentioned your grandmother, and you speak about her, gave a very beautiful description of her. Was your grandfather a farmer?
No, he was a lawyer.
A lawyer?
There's a whole book on that. The Crusader.
I don't have to read Crusader. Well, I didn't talk about much about my grandfather.
Well, you said your grandmother had four children.
Yeah, she had five. She had one died.
One died.
I'm not very on to clams. This chowder that Jackie made is really marvelous.
Yeah, she cooks. She can cook things up in a jiffy.
Yeah, the house is still there, but it's deteriorating. The next time I go, I think it's going to be gone.
Uh-huh. Is the land still around it, just like this picture, in the picture book?
The village is very much the same.
There hasn't been any kind of expansion?
What?
There hasn't been any expansion to absorb it?
Well, villages are decaying, not expanding.
Yeah.
And the economy is... I was a 60 or 80% absentee landlord, owned by corporation. So is the home in the West.
Yeah.
But that's part of my history. From the 1900, the Middle West went from the homestead farms and the democratic structures to the corporate farming. That's one of the most important parts of the time of my life in the Middle West.
Yeah.
I mean, now the Japanese just bought half of Wisconsin. They're going to have the biggest soybean farm there. They're going to have the biggest soy operation. They're going to have a factory. The Wisconsin people fought it. It's owned by Iranians and Arabians.
But when you were...
it's really fantastic.
When you were born, it was mostly just wheat and corn and small farming. I mean, individual farms.
It was a homestead. Homestead Act was one of the great democratic...
40 acres and a mule.
That was a great democratic... The homestead gave everybody 160 acres free. It was the first time in the whole world such a thing ever occurred.
Yeah, I had a friend of mine who grew up in Kansas, and his grandfather got 40 acres and a mule when the slaves were freed.
Yeah. That was after the Civil War.
Yeah, but they were still there. He was born there. They were still there on the farm when he was born.
Yeah, they gave it. Blacks and soldiers.
Yeah.
But that isn't anything. You can't hardly make a living on that.
Right.
If you get a mortgage, and then you lose your farm.
Well, what was your father's background? You said he was a lawyer, and
that's my grandfather.
Your grandfather was a lawyer.
He was on the Lincoln Circuit in Illinois. Quite a famous criminal lawyer. Quite a rounder, I suppose, too. You know, married this town virgin, my grandmother, like he always did in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Raped her the first night.
The Did your grandmother tell you this?
What?
Did your grandmother tell you this?
Tell me, she was living. She hated sex visits. Well, that she wasn't unusual. That was true. The good woman, the good Christian parent woman, hated sex. They weren't even supposed to feel any pleasure in sex.